We may feel rage against toxic individualism or narcissism. And our tradition, as I've noted repeatedly, is so heavily in favor of personal responsibility and communal responsibility rather than individual freedom or autonomy. I'll give a few examples that seem to indicate a concern about personal freedom, but they are clearly in the minority. They are the exception that proves the rule. This week in the parasha, we learn the law of the mamzer, easily translated as bastard, but really meaning one born of unlawful relationship, typically born out of adultery. And personally, my theory about that is that it protects men against the evolutionary concern of cuckolding, such that they would have excuse and pretext and legal recourse not to raise children who are not genetically their own. Be that as may. There is also a phrase in this week's parasha, Ish Becheto Yumat, chapter 24, verse 16, that each person must die according to her or his own transgression, that we each are responsible for our own actions. And elsewhere in the Torah, we're told that we're responsible for the flaws and defects of other generations and other persons in our community here. But here, in this week's parasha, there is, at least in that verse, a sense of individual freedom that comes with individual consequence. But again, those are, to me, the exceptions to prove a rule. There are moments in Torah, and rarely in Deuteronomy, that suggest that we have individual freedom to choose. But for the most part, what we are struck with and weighted by and freighted with is responsibility. So one of the fascinating mitzvot in this week's parasha is the mitzvah of the levirate marriage. We call it yibum in Hebrew. That if there are two brothers and one brother married ought die, the other must or ought to marry the deceased, the widower's wife, the widow herself. Now, which was easier, one can imagine, in a polygamous society. And there was resistance to it, also probably for evolutionary reasons, that one would be taking on children who were not one's immediate genetic progeny, but also for probably reasons of inheritance and reasons of personal pride, one might imagine. So one might deny, in a rare case, this obligation, but it was considered somewhat scandalous. And so the widow would go to the man in front of the elders, take off his sandal, I think, and spit in his face. And he would thereafter be called Beit Chalutz Na'al, the one who walks without a shoe, which is a sort of a stigma of knowing that this person had denied and abnegated their responsibility to another. And so in this moment of toxic individualism, I want to think that through. I'm going to show you several mitzvot that are almost extreme in their demands that we care for each other. The Akadat Yitzhak, who is Isaac ben Moses Arama, who wrote in Spain right before the expulsion, says that humankind attains an ideal state via a threefold process, via a threefold cord. One must fulfill duties towards oneself. So there is a sense that we do have personal freedom, personal needs, an understanding of what could be called a healthy narcissism, a healthy self-regard. One must fulfill one's duties towards one's fellow, and one must fulfill duties towards God. And he goes on to read the verse, chapter 6, verse 8 of Micah, that describes those tasks in three parts as doing justice, practicing loving kindness, and walking humbly with God. I don't know how he understands doing justice to be personal responsibility, personal self-regard. Be that as it may, practicing loving kindness is duty towards one's other, and walking humbly with God is duty towards the divine. And that duty toward other is obscenely vast in our tradition, not only represented in several mitzvot this parasha, this week, but expanded by the rabbis with a concept called lifnim mishurat hadin, which we would roughly translate as going beyond the letter of the law, but they understand as taking less than the law might allow you to. So yes, legally, in some states, you don't have to wear a helmet when you ride a motorcycle. But there would be a recognition in our tradition that you ought to, Because even though it's only your own head, there is an immense guilt that might be felt by the person who was part of that car accident that killed you. I think about that when I play soccer and some people don't take off their earrings. And I think, come on, you know, I know it's your ear, but I'd feel terrible if anything happened to it. So these wild and extreme requirements to care for one's fellow start, among others, with the idea of returning lost objects. It's in this week's parsha and also in Parshat Mishpatim, I recall, but expanded dramatically in the Talmud of Bava Metzia. Rather simple chapter, which is a good place to start Talmud study. The masters, the sages, taught that there was a dealing stone, a claimant's stone, Evan HaToen, which I like the sound of that, in Jerusalem. And anyone who lost something would go there, and anyone who found something would go there. This one would stand up and declare what they had found, and this one on the other side would stand up and describe the item, the serial number on the dollar bill, so to speak, describing its signs and notes, how it was dented, what color it was, whether there was a fleck of paint, so to speak, whether the animal had a scar, some identifying mark to claim it. What's also interesting about that, not just that it requires people in Jerusalem to gather regularly at one spot and sort of have this lost and found, I mean, it's essentially a lost and found as we'd recognize it, they don't say in every city. I'm not sure they didn't mean in every city, but the fact that it was only in one city suggests an extremely onerous process of bringing a lost item from Tzfat or the Galilee or even the desert areas of the land of Israel and Judea to this dealing stone, the Evan HaToen in Jerusalem. So there was a demand to go out of one's way, not just physically, geographically, but also even to do this with one's enemy. One had to be careful to return properties and of any size and I think almost any significance. Right? And then there is, at least in the Bible's understanding of public health and the Bible's understanding of hygiene and sanitation, there's concern for communal sanitation. I think that's what underlies chapter 23, verses 11 through 14, when we're told, and I find it fascinating, parenthetically, that the Torah has so many rich ethical mitzvot and so many powerful ritual mitzvot, and occasionally it just has a weird, simple, strange, trivial-sounding mitzvah. So what we're told among our things that we must carry into the field is a trenching tool, something for digging. We used to have it when you'd go hiking or backpacking. For poo or for other bodily emissions, that we had to go outside the camp, dig a trench, dig a hole, and bury your feces, which is, I mean, that just protects water supplies. Right? So there's a sense, an understanding very early on that public health is a public good and a public responsibility, which I think is the most glaring example and symptom of our toxic individualism of this age, but really growing and growing for decades, maybe even centuries in America. Less so in some other countries that have a broader sense of community, but again, parenthetically, if you watch shows, programming, and documentaries about life within Orthodox or fundamentalist community, the pressure of communal conformity is also obscene in a very different direction. But we do have great, almost unlimited responsibility toward our neighbor, according to Torah. People lived in mostly two-story houses, and the lower story would be sort of the pens for animals, and the upper story would be where some of the living spaces were, not usually cooking. And in the heat, sometimes people would sleep on the roof. But you had to have a parapet. I don't know the American law about this. We were discussing this a bit in Torah study on Monday. But you're required, you have liability for other people's stupidity, let's say. You have liability should someone come up to your roof, even drunk one can imagine, and fall off your roof. That's your problem, not theirs. You have to set up a parapet. Again, one of these mitzvot that seems so odd, so concrete, in some ways so particular and time sensitive, time related. That it's odd that the Torah, a document that aspires to universal sanctity and eternal sanctity, would concern itself with it. And the Torah notes Rashi and Sifri, the Midrash, that it's described this person as the falling or fallen person, right, who falls off your house without a parapet, meaning that this is going to happen whether you liked it or not, whether you were there or not, but you shouldn't be the one responsible for the death. Right? Don't participate in it in any meaningful way. You have a responsibility not just to care for actively, not just to be, to use an ironic and anachronistic term, a good Samaritan, but to actively protect your neighbor, to actively wear a seatbelt, to actively not smoke in public. It goes quite far. Almost, and certainly I think what's illustrated by all these is they're inconvenient, right? It would be so much easier to build a house without building codes, to keep objects after a little while if no one came to you, to find something on the ground and say, now that hat is mine, right? But you had to inconvenience yourself for the communal good and for the necessity of others. And there were limits to what you could claim. On the flip side of that coin, there were limits to who you could be, how much was yours. We talk about the mitzvot of gleanings and leaving the corners of the field, leket and peah, that like in that famous early modern painting, there were parts of the field you just didn't claim. You left the corners of your field for the poor, for the widow, for the indigent, for those who are vulnerable and hungry. You could, I mean, that was your field. It was your property. There were property rights, but there's a sense that not everything belongs to you and not everything is your due. Right? There is no ought that pervades your needs, that takes your needs out into the public sphere and you can use as sort of a cudgel against other people's needs and other people's safety and other people's well-being. And there are even limits in the converse. So you can claim if you're going through your neighbor's field and you see a grape bundle of grapes that looks good, you're hungry, you're walking home from work, you can take that, but you can't come with a basket. You can't be greedy. These things function in both directions, that we have to make space for the other in a way that America, at the very least, I can't speak for other countries, needs to remember. Needs to be reminded of, and maybe that's part of our Jewish destiny, is to remind people that it's not all about the individual. And again, in this case also, the requirements are pretty onerous. Not only do you have to have leket and peah, but it has the force of a vow. When you vow to give things to charity, not only have you made a pledge, but you have to fulfill it quickly. Like returning a lost object and traveling far to do it, like building a parapet that you don't need on your own roof, like leaving parts of your field for without claiming them yourself. You have to do it quickly and seriously and mindfully, aware of those who are in need and those around you. It's a great memory. I mean, it's like four-year-olds have only a sense of narcissism. And teenagers have only a sense of hypocrisy. But adults come to understand, God willing, if they don't remain forever childish and children, that the world is vague and the boundaries aren't so clear and nothing's consistent and we are enmeshed in a way that we might not like. You know, I think there's some line that two books that every teenager, usually boys, read are Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. And one of them is a fantasy about danger and heroism, and the other one has orcs in it. So you have to think about those books. And sort of Ayn Rand and objectivism are the opposite of what Judaism promotes. This sense that all that matters is the I, the me, is not where we go. And one of the most beautiful mitzvot, I think, in Deuteronomy, uses this odd word that seems to me to be connected to hide and seek. Don't remain indifferent. The word it uses is hit'alem, to obscure oneself, to make oneself hidden. It might even be the word that's used in political writing about societies that make dissidents disappear, right? Don't disappear yourself. Don't close your eyes. Don't make yourself blind. Don't make yourself absent to the other. And Rashi says it requires overcoming lichbosh one's eyes as though you don't see. It's almost an active process of stepping away, of denying your responsibility, of walking away from the communal contract. And I understand there are people out there who can't get vaccines because of health issues. I understand there are people out there who are wary to do it because they're afraid of missing 2 days at work at their low-paying hourly job at which they might lose and become destitute if they get a reaction to the vaccine. I don't understand. And here's the one that makes me furious, honestly. It's not wearing masks. Because my kids, for a year and still, little children, not just my kids, wear masks 30 hours a week, so much so that they have tan lines from their masks, and they haven't once complained. And I can't stand adults who view it as this inconvenience, this personal freedom issue. Right? Stop whining, to quote Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, to heck with your rights. Right? We got to take care of each other. Stop. And I know in many cases I'm just preaching to the choir. I know you are fulfilled and filled with these Jewish virtues of community responsibility. But I wish there were a way among us to spread that message forth. That it's not all about the you or the I. It's about the us.